Saturday Night Live Friday speaker meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous held at Westgate West in San Jose, California. Our speaker is John C. of Los Gatos, California. The original recording of this meeting is kept in the SNL tape library. Please observe the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and please do not play this recording for commercial or entertainment purposes. Please do not break the anonymity of the speakers or any other AA member at the public level. Thank you.
My name is John. I'm an alcoholic. I'm delighted to be here. I am particularly delighted to be sober and alive in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Just before the meeting, I made a comment to a friend of mine. I said, this is better than Lodi. And they expressed an interest what Lodi is, because I've had the privilege of speaking at a number of different places, a number of different towns, but my first major speaking engagement up in the big time, I had arrived, you know. I was asked out of town to speak. My wife and I were to go, and we were going to overwhelm them with our importance. They wanted several months in advance so they could spread the word that we were coming, and it was a potluck dinner, and we went there, and I got there a day early just to survey the place to make sure that I could really speak. And when you get a day early in Lodi, baby, you've seen it all. Anyway, we left and we went to the club to start the speaking engagement, and it was a little tiny room. It was an Olano club, and it was as small a little Olano club as I've ever seen. And I'm a little disappointed because I expect at least 1,000 people, and and I don't know how many were stuck in there, but as it went on, the room got full, more and more full, until it was just virtually wall-to-wall people, and my ego was reasonably satisfied. Even if it was a small crowd, they were going to have to stand only, which is appropriate for me. And then they had their potluck dinner, and everybody left. When we started our speakers meeting, there were three of them. So you are, unless you leave, this is a hell of a lot better than Lodi. I introduced myself as an alcoholic, and I have to tell you that when I got to the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, that's a piece of information I didn't know. I acquired that information from staying here. My sobriety date is March the 12th, 1976. My home group is Saturday Night Live. And for both of those pieces of information, I shall be eternally grateful. I am grateful for the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that loved me so much, even though I did not know you existed. They loved me so much you sent a person to come and get me, because I couldn't find you by myself. This person had 5 days, and he came to me where I was, in a saloon where he should not have been, and told me about you, and I said, "Who gives a rat's ass?" Then he said further that I would like you, and I knew he was lying, but he was far too big for me to throw out. And somewhere along the line, my mouth betrayed me, because when he asked me to come to an AA meeting, I said yes, and I meant no, but I said yes, and always having been a man of my word. And I think all drinkers like to think they're men of their word. I was stuck, and I slid that drink back, and that was my fourth drink, and I have not had a drink since then. And only by the grace of God manifesting himself through the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous could I stand and say that. Everything that I have that is of any value to me was given to me as a direct result of coming here, and only here, because I have lived a long time, in case you cannot tell. I'm almost 24 years sober, and I was 48 when I got here, and just do the math. Okay, it makes me a sprightly 72 years old, and I've never had it so goddamn good in my entire life. People look at me and they say, "Well, you don't look that old. It must be your genes." And I said, "Well, I can't tell you the answer to that, because in my family, the Carneys, by tracing back at least 7 generations, no male of Carney has lived past the age of 55. They have died through wars, accidents, and alcoholism. So I don't have a clue how long. Hell, I might just still be a young man. I might have another 40 years left for all I know. But I tell you this, if I got that much time, it's going to be in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, my earliest recollection is a very small boy, and I don't have much recollection as a small boy. But you see, my hero was my father, and I don't know what your hero was, but my hero was my father. But my father had bouts of alcoholism. I didn't know what it was at that time, but he had bouts of alcoholism. He got drunk. Usually when he got drunk, he would disappear for months at a time, 3 or 4 months, and then come home and said he got lost on the way home or something like that. I believed him. But occasionally when he did come home, he would fight. He was a fighter. And when he fought basically with my mother. I came from a relatively large family, and I can remember holding on to my father's foot as he would to try to drag him down, because I was just a little guy, just because I didn't like him when he drank. Now, I'm not trying to tell you under any circumstances that is the reason why I'm an alcoholic. No way. I am an alcoholic because I earned it. I drank alcohol. I drank a lot of it. What I am saying is that I came from an alcoholic family, and that I had vowed that I was not going to be like my father, and I never was. He drank beer. I drank bourbon whiskey. Now, most of you can understand that. Who likes beer? For God's sake, a man's drink is bourbon whiskey, and my dad was not the man I wanted him to be. You know, and I was a good little boy. At least I like to think I was a good little boy. My mother thought I was a good little boy. I was her little baby boy, and I just did my damnedest to be a good son. I loved my brothers and sisters, and I had quite a few of them, and I was a good little boy. I got pictures of me at home to show you. I was the cutest little shit you'd ever want to see. I just hung it up on a wall. I'm just darling little boy. Obviously, I changed somewhere along the line. But, you know, and the only reason I bother with stories like that is to tell you where I came from, to tell you it is unlikely that I should arrive in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous to have the things happen to me since I got here. Because, you see, I believe I drank every right and privilege that a man could possibly own. I drank them away, and I wasn't entitled to a damn thing while I got here. But as I say, alcoholism brought out the very worst in me, the majority of the very worst, and Alcoholics Anonymous brings out the very best in me. Somewhere around in the age of 15 or 16, and I do not know exactly, I come from an Irish family, not Irish Catholic. That probably makes me weird, but that's neither here nor there. My father had a rule in the house that since my three brothers had to endure it, I had to too. You see, when I reached a certain age that my father would determine, it was time to call me out and find out whether I was a man or not, and I had to fight him. My other three brothers didn't do that, and I respected them tremendously for that, because I thought it took a real brave man not to fight. But I stood there and defied my father, and he knocked me down. And I got up, and I asked my mother, can I fight him? And she gave me permission to do so. And I kicked his ass, and he carried the scars to his grave for the beating he took, and I didn't even know I could fight then. But something happened to me that day, because you see, somewhere along the line, in those few minutes that was involved in that fight, I grew muscles and I got bad. And I got respect, and I suddenly realized I was a man and I could whip anybody's ass. And I set out to prove that. And I started drinking when I was in the Army. I was 18 when it started. Already I had an impressive record in the boxing ring. I had a number of titles, and people, it was really special to be treated the way I was treated, because everybody seemed to admire me, wanted to hang around me and buy me drinks. By that time, I was a Golden Gloves champion for the state of California and Texas, and I had a Ninth Service Command and 6 Army championships. And I was undefeated, and I knew that I could take anybody along the line. And I walked that way, proudly. Occasionally, there would be somebody that would be foolish enough I'm not bragging, I'm saying that I didn't learn how to fight, I was born that way. Some people are. I find that a lot of people know how to fight, but damn few people know how to fight very well. And I was one of those people who was born with an ability, and I found out when I got sober it wasn't an ability to fight so much as I was afraid to get hurt, so I had to hurt somebody first. That's the long and the short of it. That's the reason I was so damn fast. Good God, if I wasn't fast, you'd hit me. And I don't want to get hurt, I'd prefer to hurt you. But I remember sitting in the Green Frog in El Paso, Texas. Everybody's looking at me, and I like everybody looking at me. I don't know about you. You know, one of the things I like about Alcoholics Anonymous is that most of us are alike. Look at me, look at me, look at me. No, you're looking at me. Don't look at me. That's the way it is. I want everybody to look at me, but I don't want anybody to see me. I want everybody to admire me, but I'm not going to do anything to be admired. I just want you to know. Anyway, I'm in the... I was supposed to say things like that in the podium at Alcoholics Anonymous. But I was in the Green Frog in El Paso, Texas, and I started trying drinks. I've never had a drink of anything in my entire life, and I'm 18 years dry. Because that's exactly how old I was. And this, by the way, happened to be in World War II. That shows you how old I really am. I tried all sorts of drinks that they offered me. And finally, when they all tasted so nasty that finally I took a swig out of the bottle and I had come home. Because I took a direct shot of bourbon whiskey and it was the finest tasting stuff I'd ever tasted in my entire life. And because of that and the fact that I didn't want to be like my daddy and I wanted to be a fine, controlled drinker, that it took me 10 years to learn how to put water and ice in it. And another 10 years to learn how to put a dash of soda in it because I wanted to be a refined drinker. I didn't want to do what my dad did, and I didn't want to go out and disappear for months and months and months. Okay. I got out of the Army. My Army career ended when they passed a law during the war that if you were a serviceman, that you had lost an immediate member of your family during the war, they had to transfer you to the base closest to your home. So I stopped fighting, and I went up to San Pedro, California. It became an MP. MPs drink on duty, in case you didn't know that. I learned how to drink, really learned how to drink, because I don't know, once again I'm talking about old stuff, but I was barracked in with a bunch of badasses. I do not know how it qualified me in there, but there were seven of the meanest, toughest people I have ever met in my entire life. All seven of them had come from the death march of Bataan Peninsula, and they were crazy. They were absolutely insane. You had to do exactly what they did, or they were willing to kill. And so I learned a little bit more information how to survive by living with those people. I got out of the Army, and I married my high school sweetheart. I don't talk a lot about alcohol, but you got to see it guiding my way, and it will come to pass. I married my high school sweetheart. She was a lovely young lady, and I was totally in love with her. And we had our first little baby. I was 20, and she was 18. And when I saw the little girl that was born to me, I avowed that I would no longer have to run the streets the way it was. Shortly thereafter, in a altercation that occurred in the very bad section of cities and the streets of Los Angeles, I got in an altercation, and some couple of people got grievously hurt, seriously hurt. And that's when I avowed that a person like me should never ever hit anybody again. And I will have to tell you, that's a vow that I have kept from the age of 21 to this date, because grievous things happen when I get in a fight. Although I must admit that in these years that there have been many, many people that needed me to hit them. I got in a fight once with a drunk. And these are the stupid... I just got stupid things happen to me when I drank. I was at a friend's house, and he went on some New Year's Eve, and he went out to get more liquor, and everybody else is swacked. And there was one bad drunk that I really didn't like. And suddenly people come running in and said, "That Joe backed out and hit the car across the street. The guy come out of bed and started running down. And the guy's only got one arm and Joe's beating him up. Will you help me? And I say, yes, I'll go help you. So I got Joe and I wanted to hit him, and his wife said, please don't hurt him. So I'd pick that bastard up and throw him down. And he'd get up and I'd pick him up and throw him down. And he'd get up and I'd pick him up and throw him down. And every once in a while I get my fist back, I'm going to whack that sumbitch. His wife jumpy, please don't hurt him, don't hurt him. I always had respect. My mother taught me a wonderful thing, that is to love and respect women. And I always do, even when they're not respectable, I tell you that. And that lady was not respectable. At one time, I've got he and I were nose to nose. I don't know how these people did it. He and I were nose to nose, and this time I'm going to blast him. And suddenly she screamed, he dropped, and she hit me. With a car. One of those pedal cars. Well, he got three broken ribs, and the owner of the part of the house that we were visiting came and looked at me, and to show you the lack of respect that I got, remember I told you that he was beating up this one-armed guy way back when. And my friend said to me, he said, John, what the hell are you doing? We finally caught that one-armed bastard, and you let him go. I don't know if you ever heard about the fugitive or not, but anyway, I still haven't hit anybody, and like I said, and there's an awful lot of people that need it. But I married my high school sweetheart and changed my whole life. Two things, the fact that I couldn't fight anymore and the fact that I was in love with her and my daughter. And I went into business and I became very, very successful. And 10, 11 years later, we have five little girls. I am a major success in the construction industry of the corporation that I worked in, the architectural metals field. And I come off of a running drunk talking on the telephone and I heard this. Your wife has committed suicide. And I went mad. Absolutely mad. I don't know a great deal about what happened after that. I know that somebody suggested I would sit down and I didn't want to sit down. I know that I came to in a straitjacket with a lot of people still sitting on me. And then I remember coming to in the psychiatric wing of the Los Angeles General Hospital, and I'm still in the straitjacket, and I'm still, this time I'm strapped down on a gurney. And I'm listening to these people talk about the crazy man that they had to put in there and how many people it took me to do that and how he demolished this building and all that rest of that crap. And I'm looking up and I'm seeing a doctor looking down at me, and this is what he said to me. If I let you go, will you hurt me? And I couldn't answer him. Because God damn it, I did not know. All I could do was cry. You see, I had a lot of injuries from the fighting or whatever the hell happened that day. And he wanted to sew me up. And I couldn't answer him. And I had five little girls. I did not know whether they were alive or dead. And I loved and adored that lady. And I loved and adored my children, and I didn't know where they were, and I didn't know anything other than the fact that I didn't want to live. And I came to in another little room, maybe you've been there, and now I've got them strapped down with a leather belt and the handcuffs that are attached to the belt. And I'm sure that some of you have been there. I'm in his room, and it's all soft. The walls are soft. They got this damn steel door and a little sliding window in it. And every once in a while, they'd open up that window and look in at me. And sometimes I'd see them and I'd crawl back into that black hole that I was hiding in because, God damn it, I didn't want to come out. I just seemed to know that I had the ability to go into a coma and stay there. I just seemed to know that I didn't have to face life. And nagging on my heart, nagging in my soul, was the knowledge that I was a murderer. I was totally and irrevocably responsible for the death of that lady. And that I had five little girls. I didn't know where they were. And I had to stay alive. I had to get out. So about 80 hours later, I was led out of that place to grab my little girls. While I was in the hospital, a company that I worked for sent word that I was fired because I didn't project the right image of the corporation in the management structure. Not only was I fired, I was blackballed in the industry in Southern California. I got my little girls together. I once went to one of the companies, one of the major companies that had been trying to hire me away for quite a while. And I walked up and I said, "Bill, I need a job." And he said, "Yes, John, I know." I said, "Well, you've been trying to get me for a long time. I'm here." He says, "John, I give you a job because I've always wanted you to work for me. Come to work Monday." And I went back Monday and I'm all suited up and I'm ready to go to work. And he said, "Come on into my office." And I said, in his office, he said, "John, I am sorry. I have on my desk a petition that is signed by every employee that I have stating that they will not work for this corporation if you do." So whatever I did while I did it seemed to make the papers and offended an awful lot of people, including me. So I grabbed my little girls and moved to Northern California, vowing I'm going to be the best damn father and businessman that you could possibly be, because nobody in the world loved my children as much as I did, because you know those bastards down in Southern California is where all the fault lies. If you move to Northern California, you can do it right. So I came up here all alone, and I turned into the best damn father you'd ever want to know. I learned how to cook, iron, before wash and wear. Remember, I told you I was old. I have five little girls, and all they had was these fancy little dresses. I like to tell the story, and most those of you who heard it, it's just too damn bad you're stupid enough to come here tonight. But I had my oldest girl, who was 11, 10, 11, I don't know. I changed my first diaper in Northern California. I had five little girls and I had never changed a diaper, and I was proud of it. Shows you what kind of a husband I was. Anyway, one night I'm sitting there, I come home and I immediately start cooking dinner. And then I feed the children, and then we play for a while, and then I give them a bath, and I'd put them to bed. And then I would do the housework, do the cleaning and the washing and the ironing. And I was up pretty late, and I was ironing my daughter's dress. My oldest daughter had this gorgeous little brown peasant-type dress with lace, rolls and rolls of lace, and lace yoke and puff sleeves with all the... Oh, God, she looked like $1 million in that thing. She was the prettiest thing you'd ever want to know. And I was sitting there sipping a little bit of Jack Daniels. And by the way, in case you have ever ironed and you want to know how to iron, I have heard my mother and sisters talk about how difficult it is to iron, stand over this hot iron. And I vowed that I would not stand and iron, so I learned how to iron sitting down. And if you learn how to iron sitting down, you're going to have to learn how to do it left and right-handed. Otherwise, you're going to go crazy. I got pretty damn good with that thing, plopping that dress back and forth and sipping a little Jack Daniels. And while I was ironing this particular dress, apparently I got distracted for just a second or two, and I scorched the lace. This was my daughter's favorite dress, and I was in a quandary. I didn't know what the hell to do. I examined that scorch area, and it looked kind of brown. So I spent the next 2.5 hours scorching all the rest of the lace to match. I told you I was a good father. Good, and that little snot never wore that dress again. Those kids were not very nice to me. I worked for a company in South San Francisco. I was a division manager, and I held the title of chief engineer. I controlled all of the production of a product that the company that fired me used to make. They discontinued that product and signed a contract with my corporation to buy all of the material which I fabricated from me. They had 11 companies in 11 western states, and I knew every one of the rotten, filthy son of a bitches. And every ounce of material that left the front door came from me. I controlled it all. And I made it rather difficult for them to get their material. Johnny O taught me when I first got in here, don't harbor resentments, get even fast. I had those poor slobs were just pleading for material. John, do this. John, do that. And one day I got a call from a lady in production control. She sounded nice. She seemed to know what the hell she was doing. I enjoyed talking to her. And we talked, and she would call me the next day on another project, and I thought that was rather cool. This was a swift young lady. And after talking with her for a while, I said, spread the word, woman. She said, what's that? I said, I'm not going to talk to any member of your corporation except you. So all of the managers of the 11 western states had to go contact this young girl in production control if they wanted to talk any business with me, including the owner of that damn corporation. I wouldn't talk to anybody but her. So needless to say, we got to know each other as well as we could possibly be. All I knew is I was as truthful with her as I was capable of being, as she was truthful with me as she was capable of being. And I decided to hire her. And so I was going to hire her, but I wanted to see what she looked like first. It's not that I'm a bigot, and it's not that I have prejudice, you understand, but I wanted to see what she looked like. I had asked a number of people that worked for me as what did she look like, because they had seen her, and I had never seen her. She worked in San Francisco and lived in Berkeley, and I worked in South San Francisco and lived in San Mateo at that time. So I asked her out. We go out and have a sociable business dinner. Now, I've always had a keen eye for women. I love women. I just think they're the nicest people that come down the pike. And I have a real eagle eye. I can spot things that normal people can't. This lady lived in a little apartment in Berkeley, and it was a two-story apartment, and she had the second floor, and it was a little tiny place, and when you walked down the stairs, the whole damn building would rock. She told me that she had a boy and a girl, and she knew that I had five little girls. She was a gay divorcee when gay meant having fun. I told you I was old, you know. So anyway, I come up to this house, and I pound on the door, and this gorgeous little girl comes coming down the steps. She's the prettiest little girl I've ever seen in my life. She was three. But she didn't have a good mother. I could tell that because her nightie was torn and not mended. And I would have mended it. So automatically I got a big strike against this woman. I haven't even met her yet. But she sure throws pretty children, you know. And then I looked up. At the top of these narrow goddamn stairs, and there's this huge woman up there. And with this eagle eye of mine, I can instantly spot that she wears falsies. And I'm sure if you look, I can imagine what she saw. Ball-headed old bastard. Anyway, we went out and had a wonderful time. And I asked her for a date. And she wouldn't go out with me. Woman was nuts. So I asked her for another date, and she said, okay. It's a little difficult when you live in San Mateo and she lives in Berkeley, and I got five kids to get a babysitter, and she's got two to get a babysitter. So I went over there at her house. You know, I'd be damned if I found out she didn't wear falsies. The woman molested me is what she did. 8 weeks later, I married her. And it's the greatest thing that ever happened to her. The woman was an Al-Anon, born and raised to be an Al-Anon, waiting for an alcoholic to happen to her, and I gave her fulfillment. At the age of 26, she suddenly got 7 kids. 2, 3, 4, 5, 7, 9, and 12. I proposed to her in the shopping center and market between the peanut butter and the mayonnaise. And I said something like this. I didn't say something like this. I said exactly this. Because I have repeated it a few years and she has reminded me a couple of times. I said, "Stick with me, baby." I always had a flair for the language, you understand. "Stick with me, baby. I'll take you places you've never gone. We'll do things you've never done, and we'll see things you've never seen." And by God, I kept my word. Every year from there on in, we made less and less money. I became unemployable in Northern California. I wound up in an entirely new trade and went to Southern California and got unemployable in Southern California. Alcohol had a little bit to do with it. I went to Fresno. Crashed and burned and become unemployable in Fresno? The cesspool of creation is Fresno. Good God, if you got to die, that's the place to do it. And I got to tell you, this is a draw. I've got a couple drunken stories that I just tell because they're just absolutely stupid. They're not important, they're just stupid. I took a drink in Fresno and came to in Chico. That's how bad Fresno is. In a $5 a night hotel room, alone, thank God for that. Naked, oh no, I'm a pajama man. Stone naked. And I got purple stripes all over my body. They were 1/4 inch thick approximately. I didn't measure them, but I got an eagle eye, I told you that. And about 1.5 inches long. And I got them all over my body. I got them in places I can't reach and nobody else should have been able to reach. It's a horrifying thing to get up in a strange town all wasted and stagger into the damn bathroom. It was so bad in that bathroom they didn't even have a shower on the stall, for God's sake. Door wouldn't close. And I looked in the mirror and they said, "Oh my God, how are you going to explain this?" I couldn't. Thank God it washed off. Now, I don't know. You ask me, "John, what was it?" I don't know. A couple of years ago, I had the privilege of speaking in Chico. And when I was speaking, I had just discovered this story a few years ago. I didn't know it. And when I was speaking in Chico, I asked that if the person was there, hopefully a female, would you talk to me after the meeting? Now, somewhere along the line, I'm going to tell this story, and somebody's going to raise their hand, because I tell you, it's only going to take another stupid drunk to tell it, to give the other half of that story. This is not something normal people do. Oh, let's put purple stripes on that man's body. I came to in Fresno. I was once again the marriage that had started out so brilliantly and so beautifully with a woman that I absolutely adored had turned into something that was not very cool. For some reason I could not understand. I didn't understand it. I really didn't. I tried my damnedest to be a good father and a good husband, but I failed. And I knew it, and I knew it at the time it was happening, and I just didn't know why it was happening. Now, I should have known that, but I didn't know that. And I'm sitting there in Fresno and I'm unemployable and my wife looks at me and she says, "I'm pregnant." She's pregnant. Well, this is 7.5 years later, after we've been married for 7.5 years. Now, that's not a big to-do, you know. Oh, I'm pregnant. But when you've had a vasectomy and she's medically incapable of conceiving, you get suspicious. Yeah, and I discussed that a few times with some of the various bartenders in town, and they agreed with me. That's my little medical miracle, Daniel. I'm one of those 1 in 2 or 3 million people that have had 2 vasectomies. Thank you very kindly. But that's it. I was condemned to live now. Damn it, I'm condemned to live because I got one more kid coming on the way, and I'm going to have to live long enough to give him a fair start in life. And that was 9 years before I got sober, 8.5 years before I got sober. I was totally desolated. There's a line in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous that best describes my position. I had but one alternative. I did not have two. At that time, I did not have two. I had but one alternative: to go on to the bitter end, blotting out the consciousness of my intolerable situation as best I could. It was not until I got here that I found there was a second alternative: to accept spiritual help. So all I did was what I had done so many, many times. I packed my family up and came home. My home is in Fresno, or Los Gatos. For I left that damn place and I came in here to San Jose, Los Gatos, and I started my life all over again. Good God, you know, people come about how difficult it is. I know that I conned myself in a house. Just only alkalies do this crap. I conned my way into a house, a 4-bedroom house, without a first or last month or cleaning deposit. I had a job in San Francisco, and I didn't have a car and no money to buy it. I didn't have a bed, and my pregnant wife slept and I slept on the floor. So I managed to commute to San Francisco. First of all, it's a long ways. Secondly, it's a lot of walking, and it's a lot of thumbing, and there's a lot of things going down. 3 years later, I bought the goddamn house. That's my ability to gain and lose money. 3 years later, I bought that house, sales manager in a fairly large corporation, and doing well. And by the time this young man interfered with my life in Alcoholics Anonymous, when in that saloon, that busybody member of Alcoholics Anonymous told me about you and screwed up my last drunk, because I was just in the middle of it. I had more money in my bank than I had ever had. I had a job paying me more money than I ever dreamed I had. And I was doing my damnedest to hide it, because I knew I was going to lose it. I knew sure as God made little green apples, I was going to lose it again. I was going to crash and burn again. My little son, who I loved desperately, my last chance to be a decent father, was hiding in the other room. All of my children had left me. There was only my little son and one 17-year-old sick girl at home, who was still so sick that she was still pouring me alcohol. I was drinking on a regular basis, and I was no longer a periodic. I was basically drunk 4 or 5 days a week. And life was rotten. I worked for a crook I hated. The only value there was in working there was the paycheck and the fact that he bought the booze. And I hated him. My wife lived in the Ice Palace, and that's the room I didn't go into, called the bedroom. I insisted on sleeping on the couch. She insisted that I was passing out on the couch. She never had the right language. It was, on a good day, an endurance contest. She had turned into a witch. And in somehow, some way, I knew it was my fault, but I did not know why. I came here and you told me what my problem was. And I was dumbfounded. I came in and I started studying the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, well, it's always a nice thing to know, to speak in some respects when there's somebody in the room that was here when I got here. Because my fire got lit almost immediately. This is the story that I say, and it's as true as I remember it. My first meeting, I got 2 resentments, and the first 2 people I met, I was resentful against. One of them is in this room. I resented him so much that I was about to violate my tradition of not hitting anybody, because He told me that I didn't, or I heard from him that I didn't have enough guts to stay sober for 90 days. And I knew that I'd see that son of a bitch drink. I'll show him. So he gave me enough madness to go to my second meeting. So my friend who brought me to my first meeting in his car wouldn't take me home, so I had to sit through that first meeting. I went home, told my wife I was an alcoholic, and she said something like this: "Oh, wonderful, you're not a jackass, you're an alcoholic." Now we have a name for you. I went to, my friend called me up and said, "You want to take me to, want to go to another meeting?" And this was on the following Friday. And I said, "Yes. As long as we don't go back where that guy is." And so we went to this meeting, and it was amazing. These people were so much more friendly than that first meeting I went to. And he called me up, my friend called me up on the Tuesday and said, "Do you want to go to another AA meeting?" And I said, "Yeah, I want to see if they're still sober." And I went to that meeting, and I was amazed how much better they had gotten in a week. It just amazed me. My friend asked me to want to go to another meeting on the Friday, and I said, "Yes, I was looking forward to it." And I fell in love. I called my friend up on Saturday and asked him, "Do you want to go to a meeting?" He said no, and I had to go to my first meeting all alone. And I've been in love with Alcoholics Anonymous ever since. I have a thirst for recovery. I have a thirst for spirituality. I have had the good fortune of getting some tapes of a very important man in my life, and all I did was listen to the tapes of the Palo Mesa retreat. Some people here in the room would recognize it. It's made into a book called A New Pair of Glasses. I would listen to the tapes all the time, read my book sometimes while I was listening to the tapes, go to meetings and talk about recovery. That's all I did, morning, noon, and night. I rarely slept. And I was 4 months sober, and I'm learning how to pray. You know, certain things happen to me almost immediately, and I've had the very best. I've had nothing but the very best. I have to tell you that. I've had nothing but the very best. I am one of these people that didn't know the rules and was not at that time capable of really asking questions, and so I did an awful lot of listening. All right. One of the first things I had at the very beginning, I don't meet people very well. And I still don't. And I had to force myself, made a rule, to shake the hand of some person you don't know. Oh, God. I'd have to touch hands with people. Nobody hugged me, I'll guarantee you that. Because I didn't believe in that. Man or woman, no, the only person I hugged was my wife and my kids. And anybody else is suspicious. Drunk or sober. And then I decided I wanted to join you. The first thing I understood about joining is the fact that you told me that Alcoholics Anonymous was a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope. And what I heard is the fact that you had to share, and I didn't know how to share. But I had to learn how to share. So I went home and told my wife. See, I got nothing to lose. Everything I had was lost from me. Should have been lost. Frankly, I didn't want it back. Book told me that if I was going to get anything back, I would be on an entirely new basis because the old basis didn't work, and I knew that. And I knew it was my fault, so I knew I didn't have to get anything from my bride. So I went home to her one day and says, I'm gonna become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, "I thought you were." She never understood these things. I said, "Well, one of the things I have to do is join, and you join by learning how to share." And she said, "What do you mean?" And I said, "Well, I'm going to share on a topic that's really important to me, and your job is to listen, don't interrupt, and try to understand. And when I'm done, you can speak on my topic or a topic of your choice, and I will try to listen, I will not interrupt, and will try to understand." Now, I blumbled up something that meant absolutely no significance whatsoever, but it was the most important thing I could do, and I'll be goddamned if she didn't share, and it was the most painful thing I've ever heard in my life. The most painful thing an Al-Anon will say is, starts with, "Do you remember?" And I'd run to a meeting and I'd say, "Do you know what she said?" And they'd pat me on the head and say, "Go on home, do it again." I said, "I don't know how to treat her." And they say, "Treat her like another alcoholic." And I said, "Well, God, every alcoholic knows more than I do." And he said, "You got it right." So I went home and treated her like another alcoholic. With all the respect, admiration, and love that I have for any and all alcoholics, I started once again looking at the woman from an entirely different point of view. It's amazing what happened. My little boy was always hiding in the other room. He was 8 years old when I got sober. This little guy was always hiding in the other room. One evening, I'm sitting in my house all alone. My little boy's in the house too. And I can't hardly breathe because he's in the same room voluntarily with me, and he's standing behind me or he's doing something behind me. I don't know whether I was reading a book or watching television. I'm not much of a television fan, but I was in the room. And out of the blue, I'm only a month or so sober. And out of the blue, this little boy says, "Daddy, I love you." I told you I've had the best of everything. I've had the absolute best of everything. I was 4 months sober, 5 months sober, and my wife looked at me and she said, essentially, "I want what you have." And she went and joined the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Wonderful things happened to me. I worked through 12 steps of recovery. I started with the first step. First of all, I started by the fact that I did not have a God and I had to do what the book told me. Thank God the book is true. Thank God the book is absolutely true. It says in that book, it says, they are going to give me clear-cut directions of precisely how they had recovered. They told me how to start finding a God of my understanding. We got problems, so I'm going to start. You may not realize that I'm coming down with laryngitis. Beyond conception of God. The book tells me that. Now, you can all choose your own conception of God. You know, you hear a lot of things in Alcoholics Anonymous. You got a God that you don't want, throw him out the window. We'll give you a new one you can sit sober with. I never had a God. I had maybe had faith, maybe didn't. I've been baptized in seven different religions. I've had my hands laid on me by Bishop Pipe in the Episcopal Church. I was a male soloist, for God's sake, in the choir in a church in Belmont. And that didn't do anything for me. All I knew is that I was born with a pitchfork in my hand, and that's the way I was going to die. So I had to choose a conception of a God of my understanding, and this is what I did. There's a prayer. I don't like the prayers that are written rarely say anything that I really want them to do, but the prayer, "Our Father," had great meaning to me, and that's where I started from. I don't know why I have no problem with the Lord's Prayer, but it starts with "Our Father," and that's where I started to choose my conception of God. First of all, I wanted a Father that was always loving. I love my children, and there's not a damn thing in the world those kids can ever do that is going to stop me from loving them, period. I still got some. She doesn't want to cover for the last 15 minutes. And she told me when I walked in, "I'm going to die at 15 after if I talk 16 after." I wanted a God that loved me. Because I love my children, and there's not a thing in the world that my children could ever do that can stop me from loving him. So I had a God to love. I want a living God. I don't want to have a God that I had to die to see. I wanted to see the evidence of a living God, a God that's out there right now. I wanted a God of forgiveness. And that was a big problem I had, because you see, I couldn't forgive me, and if there's anything I hated in this world, it was me. And I had to have a God that would forgive me. And I wanted a God that wanted nothing but the very best for me. I started to take all of the attributes of a father that I had in limited quantities and multiplied them beyond my beliefs. And what I came up with a God of love, a God that is all-forgiving, ever-present, wanting nothing but the very best for me and you. Because I had to say, "Our Father." And that's what happened, is I found a God I started praying to him, and I got the awareness of the first step, which told me what the problem was. And I was right. The problem was me. I had a disease. I'm going to die with this disease. I can totally arrest it or die from the disease. And the arresting of this disease comes through the 12 steps of recovery, the formula for these 12 steps is the same formula for the good life. You work these steps for the purpose by which the steps are written for sobriety, and the related disorders start taking care of themselves. I told you, the related disorders. I had a wife and sick children and all of the rest of that crap, and a job I hated, and a boss that was crazy and crooked, and all of those things, and all of those things took care of themselves. I have not spent one damn second trying to fix my marriage. I'm thinking about it, I have to tell you that I have not spent one second fixing my marriage or fixing my relationship with my children. I have made amends and practiced the principles in all of my affairs. Now, those of you who know me know that I have a remarkable relationship with a lovely lady that I'm married to. I adore her as she does me. We're married 39 years in July, and we're looking forward to another 39 years. And my kids love me. They've come to love me again. They are no longer... I went, and not too long ago, well, a couple of years ago it was, one of my oldest daughter who lives in Wyoming called me, and she told me that one of her daughters, she has a large family also, one of her daughters was having some brain surgery, and that she had to go to Salt Lake City for this surgery from Pinedale, Wyoming, and that she would be there all alone. And I decided, when I hung up with her, I told my wife, honey, I gotta go. I gotta be there to support my daughter. And so I jumped on the motorcycle and I rode to Salt Lake City, and I beat my daughter there, and she was just absolutely delighted. We had a fabulous time. I spent a week there with my granddaughter, and the surgery went well, and my relationship with my daughter was just absolutely awesome. And I took a slow route home, and my daughter was concerned about me, so she called my wife, her mother, who she does now call mother, and she was worried about me, and then she told Peggy, she said, you know, Peggy, now I've been sober for over 20 years, and this is my oldest daughter, and she said, you know, Peggy, we had such a wonderful time with my daddy, and I'm no longer afraid of him. How do you do that? You can't. You can't do that. It happens. If I'd have spent a second trying to prove her not to be afraid of her, I'd terrified her and run away. Okay. I found out what the problem was, it was me, and I found out what the solution was, and it was a power greater than myself that could enter into my heart and my mind and do the things within me that was necessary to do so I could live the good life. I found out a huge truth on my third step that changed everything about me. I am a child of God. Changed everything about me. The first prayer I offered when I took my third step, the very first prayer, was I suddenly realized I had a new employer, and that my job was to do his business, and it's his business to take care of me. And the first prayer I offered is, Father, I got to go out and act like your kid. Now, I have no clue what God wants me to do, but I have a pretty damn good idea what a child of God's supposed to do. And I became one. I became one because in the process of doing these things, I was looking at the God of evidence. And I found the God of evidence within you. I recognize you're the children of God. And when I realized that you were children of a loving Creator, I knew that I had to be, because I had to be. Because if one of us is God's kids, we're all God's kids. And that's just the way. If one of us is not, none of us are. I am a loving child of a grand Creator. And I did an inventory, and I suddenly found out in my inventory, and don't listen to this crap, how difficult this stuff is. I'm one of those that said I roared through my 12 steps of recovery, not through virtue. It's with the assistance of a loving God. I roared through the 12 steps. I took my first step somewhere in the middle of July and finished my ninth step somewhere in the middle of August. And that's not because of anything I did. It's just that I have done from the moment I walked in the door to this second that which is directly in front of me, and it's none of it's out of virtue. For Christ's sake, if virtue was required in recovery, this would be an empty room. It's that simple, okay? So I did an inventory. I did my fourth step, and I found out the exact nature of my wrongs, and I quit. When I found out, I slammed my fist down and said, by God, I will never have to live that way anymore. I now know understand the underlying causes for all of my courses of action. Have you ever been in that place and say, oh God, how did this happen? Jesus, why did I do that? Oh God, I didn't want to. The story of my life. Some evil demon inside of me controlling what I did. It was me. I found out. I went to my sponsor and I said, told him what I had. And he agreed with me. He said, good work. Go home and do what the book says. And I went home. And I did my sixth and seventh step. And for a moment in time, this is what happened to me. I did a moment in time, I knew without any reservation whatsoever. I made a decision, a conscious decision, that God was going to enter in my life in a way that is indeed miraculous, and that this is what's up I had that I did not want to have. The longer you wait after an inventory, the more easy it is to negotiate. I do not believe in negotiations. I do not believe in anything other than offer a prayer and be obedient to the prayer you offer. Otherwise, a prayer is just a waste of time. I offered myself to my God in my sixth and seventh step and told him, this is a covenant, and you tell me when I'm screwing up and I will stop. I have held to that bargain. Certainly, sometimes I do not hear as well as I would like to, but I am obedient to the prayers that I offer. I believe in that. I did my eighth step. And then my ninth step. I roared through the ninth step. God delivered to me the people that were on my list in my face. Even when I was finished, I'm a little bit cocky by now, as if I'm not. And I told my lovely bride, I said, I'm finished with my ninth step. And she said, are you all finished? And I said, yes. And she said, well, I've got a couple names that I had forgotten. And this is only to impress upon you, it's the best way I can explain how God worked in my life through my ninth step. I was entirely ready. There was nothing I was not willing to do in order to clear away the wreckage of my past. It's just that damn simple. So she told me, what about David C.? We were at the Cambrian Bowl. I don't know if you know where I live, but I live by Lee High School. Okay, we're in the Cambrian Bowl, and she said, what about David C.? And I said, oh, shit, I forgot about him. I should not have forgotten about him. This is a kid that I had loaded up a gun to go shoot. He wasn't there, thank God. I talked to him on the telephone, and I said, you son of a bitch, you look over your shoulder for the rest of your life, because if you don't see me first, you're dead. Now, that's the way it was, and I hadn't seen him for 7 years. And I forgot him. I should have known, but I didn't. More is revealed to you. Thank God for the program. The book's infallible as far as I'm concerned. I came home, which is about a 10-minute drive. The phone is ringing. I answer the phone. It's my daughter who had lived in Nebraska. They went all over. When they ran a long ways. And she's talking to me, which in itself is a miracle. And I said, honey, Linda is her name. I said, Linda, dear, I have found that I need to talk to David C. Do you know ever what happened to him? She said, yes, Daddy, I do. Why do you ask? And I told her about my ninth step, because I had not yet had an opportunity. I wanted to see her face to face to do a ninth step with her. And she said, yes, Daddy, I have. Why? And I told her about step nine. And she said, oh, Daddy, I'm so grateful. Just a minute, he's standing right beside me. That's what happened to me in my step nine. I would have to hang up the telephone, walk across the street, not answer the door, or not do the things that were necessary to do in life. That's what God was doing for me. I've been doing a 10-step without fail for every moment virtually the day I got sober, but most assuredly since I've done my first 9 steps. I cannot believe of a life that is going to accumulate filth and garbage of the same kind that I got before I got sober,
that without dealing with it on a daily basis, and I came to find out on that basis, the worst that can happen to me is I'm going to make a one-day mistake. What freedom there is in knowing that fact. One day. I don't know about you, but every mistake I made before I got here was forever. Forever. And I had to refight that goddamn thing. Try to fix something that a war, it's already done. The fighting wars that we're over with. 11 and 12.
Certainly prayer and meditation. I learned how to pray. I meditate constantly. I do my damnedest, and I have from the first day to practice principles in all of my affairs. It was I found for you. I don't know about you, but once again, you'll hear how difficult it is out there. But I found it was easier to practice principles at home than it was here, because you didn't know what I was. My wife and family did not know what I was doing. You did. You'd have catched me if I had made a mistake. So I went home and practiced them. I didn't know it was going to be so difficult. If I had, I probably really wouldn't have done it. Don't listen to the negative crap about this program. Please, if it's not in the book, don't believe in it. Somebody going to say, oh, watch out for the terrible twos or the 60s. Oh, whatever. I don't understand that crap. None of it's written in the book. If it's in the book, I start to believe it. If it isn't, I don't worry about it. Step 12. When I was about 4 months sober on step 12, I practiced the principles, and I surely have had a spiritual awakening, but I finish with this particular piece of information. The prayers that I offer, I am obedient, I told you, to the prayers that I offer. And everything in my life had changed, and I was 4 months sober. And I was absolutely overwhelmed, just absolutely overwhelmed. I couldn't believe that somebody like me had been given so much, freely given so much, a person like me. My wife and children were asleep, and I fell to my knees in my living room in absolute awe. And I said this, how can you give someone like me so much? Why me? How could you give somebody like me as much as you'd given? And my father answered me in a word that I still hear this moment. Very simply, he said, give it back. And I waited until my wife came up because I didn't know what that meant. And I asked my wife. And I told her about this because now we're communicating and sharing. And she said, well, you have a step 12. And I believe what happened to you is real. And you'd better give it back. And I've embarked upon that journey. My first 12-step call was 4 months sober with a man that had a gun, and I was alone, frantically going there, reading chapter, working with others, praying to my God, oh, please, it's time for help. My business is to take care of your business, and it's your business to take care of me. And it has worked that way for me. And I fully expect that if I continue to do that which I have been doing, one day at a time for the rest of my life, the most satisfactory years of my existence lie ahead of me, because that's a promise in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I could talk for a long time telling you about other beautiful things that has happened to me. But one of the most significant things that has happened to me, if I had a wound in me that was put there by me, and there's no wound so savage or so deep put into the home and the hearts of the people of Alcoholics Anonymous, the loving God cannot heal. And my heart was all shriveled up. I was running and hiding from feeling anything, and I was trying desperately to keep my people out of my life. And my God has expanded my heart, and I love. Oh, I love my God. I love dearly my wife and children, and I love you. Because you see, I know who you are. We are all children of a loving Creator, and thank you very much.